Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Thad Toops, president at Haas & Cobb Petroleum Consultants. During the episode, Thad breaks down the underwriting side of the minerals and non-op space and how his team supports companies alongside transactions, audits, and securing bank finance. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Thad had to say.
All right, Thad, good afternoon and welcome onto the podcast. Good to have you. You know, you stopped by the booth at NAEP and we're catching up and, you know, we're making it happen here. Good to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I didn't realize you're almost like 7 feet tall until I ran across you at the NAEP booth there. But yeah, good to reconnect and glad to be on the show here.
Yeah, I always say I'm taller than I sound. And then the cutout at my booth was probably 7 feet. I'm 6'8", but that's
neat. I'll have to get one of those. We're doing a trade show booth at the CCUS conference here coming up. And I think you've inspired me to get just a life-size cutout of myself to post up there now in case I need to leave the booth, you know?
Yeah, kudos to my wife, Erica. She came up with that idea last year. She's like, you should just get it. You're so big. It would be a really funny marketing idea. Like, man, that's a pretty pompous move to get a big cut out of yourself. Like, but I was like, I love it. I think that's fun. Cause I think I know enough people where they know me, you know, personally and that, you know, it's not like a huge ego move. But what was funny last year is I had it in my booth for the first time and a couple of people who like, weren't in the mineral space, they were like chatting at the bar and they're like, did you see that asshole that had a huge cut out of himself? Like, must be such an egomaniac. And there was a bunch of mineral guys there and they were just cracking up and they told me afterwards. And I was like, hey, you know, all chatter is good chatter, right? For marketing. But anyways, I digress. So thanks for coming on. Let's jump in a little personal background to set the table here and then jump in. I think what's cool, you guys are on the underwriting side. So they always say you make money on the buy-in minerals. And so you guys are a part of that process with, you know, the days of back in a napkin, you know, cash flow multiples and all that. The space is far too sophisticated. You really have to understand the rock. And, you know, I think having a geologist at times as well to understand faulting and all that is far, far more important, especially when you're buying undeveloped and trying to understand all that. So we're going to get into that later in the episode, but before we do, a little background yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how'd you get in oil and gas engineering?
It all started in Alexandria, Louisiana, Tim. And with a last name like Toops, I was supposed to go to LSU, but I ended up being the black sheep a little bit and going over to Texas A&M. I had a buddy that went there a year ahead of me and visited him out there in College Station a couple times and really liked it. And anyway, applied there, got a little scholarship. My dad said, that's where you're going to go. Said, cool. All right. So here I am at Texas A&M. I started actually as not knowing what to do, but some sort of engineering. I did biomedical engineering of all things for a couple of years until I was ready for my first internship and was browsing around all the booths at the career fair. And there's like nobody that wanted a biomedical engineer, but a whole bunch of people wanted chemical engineers. So I said, hey, let me switch. So I don't tell everybody this, but I took 5.5 years to finish my undergrad degree, 1.5 victory laps. Yeah. So I did that and switched into chemi and lost about a year, but ended up getting a job with Citgo Petroleum right out of college in 2002. And so I went to work for old Hugo Chavez, PDVSA, their refining arm down there in Corpus Christi, where we were processing, I think it was like 165,000 barrels of high sulfur crude a day. And for some reason, they put the new engineers in those facilities in the sulfur recovery unit, which is sort of the tail end of the train. You know, all the crude comes in and throughout the various processes along there, they're removing sulfur in the form of H2S and SO2. And it all kind of comes down to this at the very end of the train where I worked, where they reacted those two things together to make sulfur and water. But what that really meant was you smelled like sulfur all the time and, you know, any sort of upset that was going on in the facility would all like kind of propagate through the processes there and ended up having major problems at the tailgate, which is where the sulfur recovery unit was. So I liked the job a lot, but I was, being the process engineer, I was on call all the time. And, you know, every other night there was some sort of upset where I'd have to go out there and try and figure out why we were polluting, you know, while we were blowing H2S out of the stack or whatever. So high stress job. And again, liked the dichotomy of being kind of the engineer, but also being outside a lot. But after a couple of years of that, and primarily my wife, a fiance at the time, not wanting to live in Corpus Christi, I said, okay, I'll move to Dallas. That's where she was. And so I moved up to Dallas, was going to knock on some doors. Mr. Haas of Haas Engineering called me up, and I was, his son and I, Brent Haas, were roommates at A&M. So real good buddies, still are.
Oh, that's funny. So that's how you got the connection there, because you've been basically a career employee, right?
Pretty much. So like a couple years out of school, I was just going to knock on doors, and he called and said, hey, we got this thing in our, this was 2004. So we got this thing in our backyard called the Barnett Shale, and we're so busy right now, we can convert you to a petroleum engineer if you want to try this. And they just needed some grunts. So I joined up as a grunt. I remember my first staff meeting, sitting there, and just, I didn't know what PDP meant. I was like, what does that mean? What are those? What is PDNP? You know, just kind of trying to follow the flow of stuff. So here I am, you know, 20 something years later, still trying to fake it like I'm a petroleum engineer, but that's how it started. And, you know, right out of the gate there, and again, this was 2004, our company, Haas Engineering, had kind of been put on the map with, the chief oil and gas sale to Devon. And so that sort of, you know, we became these shale experts overnight and started to get all the first party data from everybody that was in these shale, mostly Barnett at the time, went to Appalachia and the South Texas and Oklahoma. So we got a lot of really good exposure in all these unconventional basins right when my sort of petroleum engineering career started. So for that reason, I've been mostly unconventionally focused. You get best at what you do the most of, and that's definitely been most of my career has been in the unconventional space. Still have to remind folks, we engineer conventional assets as well. You know, we've got plenty of experience there, but that kind of sets the table for my career at Haas. And then when Mr. Haas retired in 2014, I was kind of the next guy up. His son Brent had left to go greener pastures at R. Lacey's, a VP of engineering over there, and doing some great Haynesville wells. But I was kind of the next guy up when Mr. Haas retired, so I bought the firm 1 month later. So I bought the firm into 2014, October 2014. And then I remember.
And then November, the Thanksgiving Day surprise.
I was like, what does this mean? What does this mean exactly? You know, the oil prices just started to bottom out. And I was like, oh, this is not good for a service company, you know? So we just like everybody else in the service industry, kind of had the right size and get more efficient. And in hindsight, that was great. We were able to do all those things and get sharper and make it through the other side. But that was an early learning experience for me. And fast forwarding to today, we just recently merged with Cobb and Associates, which is another third party engineering firm here in Dallas. If somebody comes to my shop 3 years ago, they say, hey, I need a water flood study, or I need you to, you know, do some simulation on this, I'd say, hey, go see the Cobb guys, because we really can't do that here. It's much, they're much more reservoir descriptive, analytical, and more classical reservoir engineering focused than what our firm had become, which was mostly kind of financial focused, right? It was mostly, we were doing reserve reports for SEC filings or bank reports or acquisition and divestiture support, more kind of high confidence transactable reserves versus let me do a deep field study on your greenfield water flood candidate. So that's why we put our firms together here in January of this year. And like I keep doing, faking it till I make it as a petroleum engineer, I can not now say I think we're a full service shop here at Haas and Cobb. And we see lots of different kind of projects, which is really exciting, and excited to kind of learn some of the stuff the Cobb guys have been doing. But right now it's our busiest season, and so there hasn't been a whole lot of time for us to integrate and knowledge share yet. It's just get these reserve reports done right away. So that's the throes of what we're in right now. And lots of those are mineral things and non-op leasehold. So happy to share information as much as I can about kind of some of the stuff we're seeing on that front. But yeah, life as a third party engineering consultant is you kind of ride the wave with the industry. When folks are drilling more actively, you get more people needing more frequent appraisals, right? So we get kind of more work as folks are more active, as prices come down, just like they do on the rest of the service providers. Hey, I'm going to need you to do that reserve report for cheaper this year. You know, you kind of write it down the other way too. So, but it's been a lot of fun. I really enjoy this career. I really enjoy working with all different types of companies and people and trying to figure out kind of what they need, maybe trying to predict what they need before they know it and helping them solve those problems on the reserve side.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at rreese@rreeselaw.com. Today's case is from the El Paso Court of Appeals in Texas and originated from a dispute in Reeves County. It's called Devon Energy Production Company versus Implat 2 LLC and answers the question of whether a deed from 1940 reserved to the grantor a 1/16th mineral interest or a fixed 1/16th royalty interest. In this case, Devon, who was the successor in interest to the grantee, argued that the reservation was for a mineral interest, which would give Implat a 1/80th royalty, while Implat argued that it was due 1/16th. The trial court agreed with Implat, and Devon appealed. There were two parts of the deed that the court used to make its decision. Focusing on them one at a time, the first part reserved to the grantors, an undivided 1/16th of any and all oil, gas, or other mineral produced on or from under the land above described. Now, Texas has a longstanding rule that conveyances or reservations that use the phrases in and under and that may be produced refer to a mineral interest. Here, the words at issue are produced on or from under. Devon argues that the rule does not require the exact words to be used, as long as similar words are being used. Implat is arguing that the words are not similar enough because the phrase starts with the word produced, so it must be referring to the minerals after they are produced, which would indicate a royalty interest. According to the El Paso Court of Appeals, that is not enough to bend Texas's in and under rule. The second part of the deed reviewed by the court involved executive rights. This one I am paraphrasing because the exact language doesn't matter that much. Here, the deed gives Devon the right to lease the land and to keep all bonus money and delay rentals, but it said that if and when oil and gas is produced, 1/16th of the value belongs to the grantors. So the question the parties asked the court was, were these words stripping a mineral estate of some of its rights or confirming that the royalty interest did not have those rights? This is the classic bundle of sticks analogy that we all know and love. A mineral owner has five separate and distinct rights that can be handed out how it pleases, much like a bundle of sticks. Those are the right to develop the minerals, 2, the right to lease the minerals, 3, the right to receive bonus payments, 4, right to receive delay rentals, and 5, the right to receive royalty payments. When you convey a mineral interest, if you don't say anything specific about these rights, it is assumed that you conveyed all these rights to the extent of the interest conveyed. Devon is arguing that Implat's predecessors reserved a mineral interest, but stripped themselves of all of the sticks except the right to receive royalties. Implat argued that this should be read as a confirmation that the deed was intended to reserve only a royalty interest. But the court pointed out that if that was the case, why go through the motions of stating all the rights that a royalty interest doesn't have? It's redundant. So the court held for Devon that the deed reserved a mineral interest and therefore Implat is entitled to a 1/80th royalty interest instead of a fixed 1/16th that it was seeking. In late November, Implat petitioned the Texas Supreme Court to hear the case. Unlike other courts of appeal, the Texas Supreme Court does not have to hear every case that is brought to it. So next we will hear if the court will take the case or if they are happy with the El Paso Court of Appeals' decision. So why do you care? Well, Implat's argument seems to turn on the placement of the word produced. If Implat is successful at the Supreme Court, we'll all need to be looking at whether our original grants say in and under and that may be produced or produced in and under. Our RNA will continue to watch this case closely. Subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow us on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with our RNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
No, I appreciate that whole background, and congrats on the recent merger. You know, whenever you can bring together different types of skill sets, experience, etc., from y'all's perspective, different basins, you know, different capabilities, then it's 1 + 1 = 3, right? I think that's where you want to merge. I'm sure there's efficiencies as well with combined staff and all that, more clients, et cetera. But let's jump in on the minerals and the non-op side, engineering and just a bunch of different things that I see come up. You know, I'm an advisor, so I work on deal flow a lot on behalf of funds in the secondary market, helping them sell off $500,000 to $10 million deals. It's kind of my sweet spot. What's kind of, I don't have an engineering background, right? So a lot of what I'm doing is bring something to market and then, you know, providing market pricing, and then we can hone in on value and get something across the line. A lot of the groups have engineering or engage you guys or your peers to do reports. And I kind of reference that. Now, you know, on not only for me, for a lot of the years, you go, okay, you know, PDP is PV10 and ducts and whips are PV15 and permits are PV20 and, you know, PUDs are around PV30, give or take. And I just kind of assumed, okay, you know, that's kind of what it is and it's pretty standard. And then I started marketing deals and folks like, yeah, we ran this at PV10 and we came up with 900,000. Someone else runs it at PV10 and they came up with 1.3 million.
Yeah.
This is on PDP. When I started seeing variability on underwriting for production, I was like, oh my God, this is more of an art than a science. And it's very challenging. And I think that's where there's winners and losers. I think that's part of what makes being in the oil business and buying minerals and non-op, you know, there's always going to be deal flow and people want to transact and a little bit of that imperfect information, if you may, imperfect underwriting process is going to create opportunity. But for you guys as a third party, consistency in that rubber stamp is important. So in that scenario I just gave you where it's kind of like, man, I'm seeing stuff, offers come in on the stuff that's supposed to be pretty standard. There's a pretty big, you know, spread there. Do you guys have core principle? One, I'd love for you to rebut a little bit the art versus science type analogy I just gave out. But then in terms of core principles and parameters, and when you're working with somebody, what do you kind of say, like, this is what we're at? And if someone gets a Haas report on a deal, like what is synonymous with that? Now, over to you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there, but I tell people everything we do is exactly wrong. You know, like we're inexact sciences here at best, right? I mean, it's all based in principle engineering fundamentals, but at the end of the day, it's an estimate what we provide. And so one of the things that's important to know when you are getting engineering done or when you're internally or externally or however you're getting kind of your technical evaluation done, it's meaningless unless that answer is presented with a confidence level, right? And a lot of times we use reserve class categorizations to do that. So proved, in other words, and probable and possible. Those are ways that the SPE has given us definitions to not only communicate, here's what we think your reserves and value are associated with these minerals or anything else. It allows us to convey how confident we are in that number. And so whether it's a third party, like I said, you know, sometimes folks will be like, oh, the third parties are so conservative, right?
I hear that all the time.
So conservative, right? It's like, well, did you know that for something to be considered a proved reserve, it's 90% confidence of meeting or exceeding that total. So to say it a different way, if I'm doing an annual update on somebody's portfolio every year, 9 out of 10 times I update production on those wells and reforecast them with new data, 9 out of 10 times I should be raising my forecast. So when you're like, yeah, you guys are so conservative, by definition, that's what proved means. And so I think one of the things that we try to communicate out there is just educating the population about that is the definition. It is practically certain, right? And even on the SEC side, so SPE guidelines say 90% confidence. SEC, they're usually more vague in their guidance, but they say it should be reasonably certain. So we interpret it the same, basically P90. But all that being said, you're not making business decisions around your P90 reserve. If you try to go take your proved reserve report and use that as your transactional bid, you're probably not going to win very many bids, right? Because it's not your, it's your, it's supposed to be your conservative case. So that's kind of where the P50, that's really what you're transacting around, is sort of that most likely case, likely is not case. And that's, I think that's important to distinguish when you're working with a third party, or when you're, even when you're talking to your own internal engineer, hey, would you consider these 90% confident or 50% confident? You need that kind of clarification to go with the estimates that we give. But yeah, so some of the other stuff you brought up there about the art versus the science, you know, if you back up to like 2016, 17, 18, when everybody started to get out over their skis, drilling big wells, and, you know, the best wells we ever drilled were like 2016. So it's, you know, I think well performance is maybe taken back up here recently with some coring up of acreage. But if you generally look at kind of well trends, it was all the parent wells that we drilled in 2016 in the Permian Basin that are still the best, you know, still the best out there. And what happened after that is folks began to say, well, that's what all my wells are going to do. So everybody's kind of getting over leveraged on estimating reserves, not considering parent child, not considering different completions. And it's very hard. It was very hard to tell how disconnected that was going to be until you get several years of histories on these new wells, right? Because we have this one plot that we show sometimes where if you look at year over year well completions, like maybe the 3 month cum per foot looks the same for this well versus that well, or the 6 month cum looks the same, 12 month cum may even look the same, but it's going to be 20% lower reserves because it, the B factors are changing and there's other things in the reservoir that are happening now. So all that to be said is that, yes, there is uncertainty in what we do. It is a science-based projection of those reserves. So we're trying to consider things like flow regime changes, because you now have a twice the completion volume that you're putting in these wells. Your stages are twice as not numerous. So there is science that goes into estimating remaining reserves on PDP, but that is something we see very routinely with data and packages. You can make a curve look very good if you're just fitting all the data with a reasonable fit, and it's going to be, it could still be 20% wrong on your remaining producing reserves just because you're not considering some of those underlying scientific principles. So knowing the reservoir, knowing kind of what to look for in those diagnostics of how that well is going to behave in the future is, like I said, I think having a technical person help you underwrite that is going to pay for itself pretty easily whenever you don't have to overpay for your PDP by 20%, right? Conversely, you may not win every deal because there's people out there, experts included, that are getting it wrong, right? And I'm not saying we always nail it exactly right, but there is an over-optimism, I think, still out there on how to do some of these things technically accurate.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors.
Looking to ramp up deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 120 deals, totaling $110 million in value, with deal sizes ranging from $50,000 upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, permit, duck, PDP, AFE, or wellbore-only deals, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source deal flow from the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests, or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Does your team ever struggle with employee turnover? What about right-sizing your team to fit your company's needs over time? Do you have the right accounting systems and software in place to maintain control and visibility on all your cost centers? If any of these things are challenges in your business, then Opportun's back office outsourcing could be the right solution. For more information, please visit www.opportun.com.
We always hear about this super low cost of capital, you know, that's out there, the family office or the insurance company, whatever. Because some folks are like, man, some of these deals are getting bid at prices that are just, they're blowing people out of the water. Is it an ultra low cost of capital? And my conference in October, the consensus after the panel kind of commented on it was, I don't think it's an ultra low cost of capital. I think it's a misunderstanding on how it's engineered. And some of these areas, like in the Delaware, that are very, very complex technically, they're, you know, for someone who may better understand it, they may be underwriting it at PV20, whereas the other group might think they're underwriting it at PV20, but, you know, maybe they're just overpaying.
One man's PV20 is another man's PV10. And yes, that's a real thing that we see all the time too. And it is, you know, if you look at marketed assets and stuff, and it's not as bad as it used to be, but data room packages, it was almost like the steroid era of baseball, you know, from 2016 to 2020, where it's like, you know, this thing is juiced, you know, but a layman can't see that it's juiced. That's the trick, right? It's a good fit curve. It all ties out. You know, when I run my cash flows, I get the same monthly income that I'm seeing on the lease operating statement. So we're good to go, but it's not, you know, there's underlying errors in there that deviate quickly from that. So, you know, it's going to be juice. It's not as bad anymore. Like I was saying, you know, more and more folks are more educated about it. If they see a package out there that's 50% too high, they're just going to punt it, right? Nobody's going to even like maybe go after that because, yeah, there's always the dumb money out there that might pay that, but it's not worth getting into a competitive situation and trying to outbid yourself.
I've heard a little griping of that over the years, and I'm not singling out any larger investment bank, but I think you can kind of just pool them all together for the purpose of this conversation. And groups are just saying, God, we're so tired of looking at these engineering projections that they put out. And like you said, they're juiced. And then, you know, the assets are still good. So you run the process, but it kind of just starts the conversation at an unrealistic number, and then it gets worked down. And, you know, especially if you're talking 50, 100 plus million dollar minerals package, which is big in relativity for minerals, all the groups buying that are very sophisticated with lots of data, their own teams, investment committees, and there's a lot going into the underwriting. So they're not taking any bank's engineering, you know, at face value. They're redoing it themselves. Where I think the value is in the evaluation pre-market for a bank to understand the value from their perspective, talk to the client, get eye to eye on, is this even sellable? And then being able to understand and walk through the value propositions from a technical perspective. But that's just kind of food for thought. I think, like you said, going out of the gate too high doesn't help anybody, including the advisor. So I think there's a balance there. But on the topic of using engineering reports in deal flow, I think the difference between a bank and someone like yourselves is that you're supposed to be third party. You can't, you know, make a success fee on a deal. It screws up the incentives. And so that whether it's viewed as too conservative or not, it is supposed to be consistent and kind of that benchmark. And so regardless of where something actually trades, having you all as a benchmark and a process, I've, you know, firsthand working deals have had third-party engineering reports involved, and it just helps sometimes sober up the bid ask, right? Maybe that's more prevalent in something with a landowner, a non-industry pro, right? To have, oh, you know, Haas's report says X, like at least that's someone outside of this negotiation telling me that. Well, I don't know. Like in your, I'd love to hear some more stories on processes you've been involved in and how it's been leveraged and all that to help with that. Because the bid ask is always, it always exists, and it's right. It's a little wider, you know, in certain times when there's volatility in price. But anyways, over to you.
For sure. And again, I go back to it's our responsibility to convey what hat we're wearing here, what confidence we have in things, right? Like we wrote this little ebook or whatever you want to call it, called The Confident Bid Recipe. And it's like, how do you not overpay for something, but understanding that, hey, if I just put my approved report on the table as my offer, it's probably not going to get the deal closed. So there, you know, there's actually John Davis with AVAD Resources gave me some of his buy side tips one time. He's like, he's been real successful at buying and selling out of mostly operated properties, but he says, you know, I underwrite it like, am I going to get crazy on these curves? I'm going to be conservative. I'm going to call this prove, which is proved. And then he's like, there's so many other factors out there with expenses or capital or prices and everything else that he's like, I usually take two of those knobs and say, what happens if like two things go in my favor, get a little 10% bump in price or get a 10% drop in operating expenses? Maybe that's my stretch bid, right? So again, it's kind of coming back to sort of framing this thing. We get several customers that our workflow involves a base and a high, right? If they give us a little deal to screen, nothing, then even on these $100 million deals, it kind of goes the same way. When you don't know exactly what the answer is, let's box it in, right? Let's do a base case scenario where this is something you could take to your bank and borrow money with it. Because sometimes you want to do that. Sometimes you do want to know what that number is going to be if I need to go put debt on this acquisition, right? So let's do a base case and let's do a sensitivity high case where we lean a little bit forward, but still a very reasonable, defendable kind of P50, you know, middle of the road answer. And usually somewhere the bid is going to be somewhere in between those two numbers. And usually that's where the third party can provide kind of those lanes to stay in. And again, it's up to our client or up to the buyer to say, yeah, but I think this has got additional upside that we're not including here. Let me stretch 10% more, whatever it is. And that's the business decision. And sometimes those work out really well. And sometimes they're right technically that there was some more upside and prices crashed down and it was a bad deal anyway, you know? So there's a timing component there, but that's how I think third parties, again, when we put on the hat of let us help you stay in the lanes here versus, okay, I'm going to file this with the SEC or these reserves are going to go to the bank. Those are two different hats that we can wear, you know, and just being clear about what's being presented is our job. But staying in the lanes is a base and a high case evaluation is always a good way to do that.
Are you serious about networking and deal making in the minerals and royalty space? If so, I expect to see you at the MARC Mineral Royalty Conference at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston on April 15th and 16th. This must-attend event will bring together over 600 attendees for two action-packed days of networking and discussions. Be sure to visit mineralconference.com to get registered for your ticket today.
Yeah, one point you bring up on, you know, getting a credit facility in line. So in minerals, the kind of the standard methodology is typically they'll lend a commercial bank who likes minerals, Texas Capital, you know, Gulf Capital, Southwest Bank, just to name a few, do 24 to 36 months on your average 6 month cash flow is what they'll lend you. Now, a lot of guys who end up leveraging that are smaller guys on the ground. They don't want to keep flipping stuff. They want to start taking stuff down and warehousing it and, you know, stretching their equity dollars because they don't have huge funds or self-funding with their partners. And so for those out there that are kind of considering going that road, I call it broker graduation, right? They're looking to now become kind of a hybrid, you know, principal investor / broker, and they want to go get debt. Pretty standard, right? A bank's going to require someone like yourselves to do the engineering. It can't be done in-house, and they're going to need that PDP valuation on their assets from a third-party firm.
That's true. Yes. Thank God for all the regulation out there. I still have a job, right? So I still get hired to do independent evaluations because they are required, right? And any sort of reserve-based loan, I think, you know, there's a minimum threshold. I think they'll do personal guarantees and stuff, you know, a couple million dollars here and there. But anything in material value, they're going to want a reserve-based loan with a third party that's looked at it. And sometimes they'll even get a third-party reserve report in and have another third party look at that. So the OCC, who's kind of the governing body of the, you know, the banks, they overreact like all those agencies do. But, you know, when we had the price crash in 2015, it was like, we need three or four levels of engineering on all these assets before we lend any money. So they swing that pendulum around some of kind of how much is required. But yes, most of the covenants are you got to have an annual reserve-based loan. A lot of the banks now will, you know, will be on a biannual calendar, but they'll allow an internal update for the kind of interim report, or they'll have the bank engineers update it themselves. But that independence is important, and not necessarily always on the buy side or the sell side either, right? Like knowing, like you said, maybe my internal engineer is a little optimistic. I want to kind of know what I really own. On the other side, on the buy side, there's a lot of folks that have, you know, pension funds raised and things of that nature that they've got to put this money to work quickly. And like, yeah, let's buy that. We got to buy something, and we don't have a company sometimes. So there's a lot of folks that kind of get that delusion a little bit too, or start to lean a little too forward into an asset because they've got money burning a hole in their pocket, literally, and they've got to place that money to work. So having that independence, I think, is helpful. Again, we're not allowed to own anything. We're not allowed to participate in anything. If I ever participated in something, every single report I put out would have to say, by the way, that tube sounds a little bit over there. And then what's the use of the report, right? Again, it's not against the rules, but I'd have to disclose all that, and just keeps it simpler to say we don't own anything.
No, that's fair. Yeah, it's the lane you're in, and you got to avoid conflicts, and it's just what it is, right? But
yeah,
that autonomy is what, like you said, it's what keeps you in business, and it's a needed part of the space.
10 years ago, Tim, I bet you 90% of our revenue was that independent third-party report of some sorts, whether it's an audit report or a bank report or an SEC filing. You know, that was what we did most of the time. In the summer times, you know, everybody just golfed all summer because there wasn't any seasonality reports due, right? Nowadays, we probably have 60% of our billed hours are towards reports, and the other 40% are an extension of your technical team, right? An extension of you guys where we're more acting as an internal tech shop for you. And so that's been, and that really kind of started happening with the Smash Co's and things like that, where they would take, you know, these management teams that had three or four engineers and smash them together. And there's one lady or one guy left that's an engineer, and they just need overflow help screening deals or whatever. So we didn't have seen a big pickup in folks using third party, not just ours, folks using third party engineers to not deliver anything official, right? Not a stamped report deliverable of any sorts.
Can you talk about the stamped versus unstamped? I know there's different pricing with that, right? But it's sometimes, like I said, my analogy with the larger banking processes, sometimes it's like that soft understanding of like values. So you're going in eyes wide open, and then you let the market speak. There's definitely value in that. But I guess for you to put that rubber stamp, and I guess for it to be like, what are the rules if it's not an official report, like, and how it can be used and everything? Because I think, yeah, like what you talked about is, you know, 40% of your revenue pie being towards this like extended engineering services type thing for shops, minerals and non-op, that's prolific. It's all about the outsourcing model is very, very real. It's all about running lean and then, you know, kind of dialing it up, engaging you guys. Hey, we need more hours. Our pipeline's really good right now. And then there's other slow periods and they could dial that back down.
Or they need a second opinion on something they looked at. Hey, it was a big check. We're going to cut. Can you guys look at it too?
Got it. But yeah. So talk to me about the official, unofficial. How does that work?
Sure. When I talk about like a stamped report, so these are defined terms, like a reserve report is supposed to contain, you know, a methodology description. It's supposed to contain sort of the pricing you're using, the net, you know, just all the assumptions that go in there. It's a cover letter that goes with the cash flow projections and the, you know, tabular one-liners or whatever their outputs you want to put in that report. But the bank's not going to loan any money on just a set of economics, right? Or a PhD Win database or an Aries file or whatever. They're going to want to see that reserve report stamped with, you know, a professional engineering license, which requires you to have at least 5 years experience in training under professional engineers doing the same thing. So that's just their way of having that protection. But yeah, most of our support work, like you're talking about, most of our acquisition support, or we've even been on the sell side before too, where we're just trying to kind of stand up an asset and get it ready for a market or whatever. All that is, again, an unofficial, like there's no official deliverable there other than just us supporting. Here's what we think it is. Here's some here's some type curves, here's some economics and things of that nature, but it's not anything that gets filed with an agency or on file with the bank.
Okay. No, that's helpful.
I don't think I've ever seen a bank lend on a unstamped reserve report before. I don't think that would be allowed by the OCC.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford. With deal sizes ranging from 50K upwards of 5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs, the Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at R. Reese & Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms, and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
Yeah, I can see, you know, for folks listening, smaller shops in particular, that unstamped report as a peace of mind or a second opinion.
Again, it's, a lot of times it's the same thing. You know, it's like, hey, we're going to put this together like it's going to a bank, but it's not. You're just using it to kind of stay in the lanes for your bid. And if you do get the winning bid, we can dust this off and get it ready for your report to go borrow money against it if that's what you want to do. So sometimes they're one and the same, but it just kind of depends on how that gets delivered.
Very cool. Well, you guys look at a lot, so I'd love to pick your brain here and get your thoughts kind of on basins and kind of what you're seeing. So space is getting competitive, right? There's a lot of money out there, a lot of teams. And so there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat and make money. A lot of times your costs of capital and who your investors are drive that. But one thing I've started to see is, you know, leasehold non-op strategies. So these could have been land guys or minerals guys in past lives. Now they're looking to get in for a lower CapEx strategy in non-op. You know, if you're going to be an AFE fund, you need a lot of capital to participate, right? So you can put together a leasehold, create a thesis, and you could do a lot of damage with $10 million. And then the AFEs come up and you sell them off. That market's fairly liquid. You carve out an override, and then you start to reinvest proceeds and And so that's a way I've seen folks kind of play in this space. And there's an opportunity there for sure. More risk, right? Because it's just like buying undeveloped minerals. You're not in control of timing and everything. So there's that. And so that is, you know, if you're leasing stuff up, you know, if it's an emerging part of a play, an extension, maybe it's a little fringier and you're trying to bet on the come of, you know, higher prices coming and that becomes economic. And then there's, you know, on the minerals buying side, with no kind of non-op strategy there, it's just playing in the fringes because cost basis is lower and it's just getting too competitive. And you're looking at almost trading dollars for some of those more developed minerals and poured up areas. And so you rather take a little bit of timing and geologic risk going to these different areas. So what are some things you're seeing around the country that are interesting in terms of areas? I'll throw three out that kind of four that have come up for me that start to hear and see people kind of sniffing around. You know, the western part of the Anadarko Basin is kind of interesting. I was just in Oklahoma, a lot of chatter around that. Anadarko had a technical reset and fell out of favor, but there's a lot of interesting stuff with Mewbourne and Devon and Crawley, et cetera, out there, a lot of rigs. The Delaware Basin really being pushed north in New Mexico. And so the bounds, there's some areas that, who was I talking to the other day? They had this non-op stuff that they looked at just offloading. It was acreage and they couldn't even get a bid. And now it's getting fully developed. Yeah. And this firm is going to participate and see how the well results go. And then, you know, look at monetization and optionality there. But yeah, that's a couple of years, right? Development's coming towards them. There's the oil leg of the Ohio Utica, which got a lot of buzz lately and kind of a long, skinny play. And a lot of that stuff has been kept under wraps. But from what I hear, some really, really big oil wells. And then the Powder, which is like the play that's going to pop. And that's been the word for 20 years. And so I don't know really how to think about that. But there's some minerals guys starting to look there, I guess, by having a sense of the Permian being a little competitive and they're just trying to go elsewhere. But I'm just the guy who, you know, drinks beers with folks in networks. You're actually looking at the rocks. So what seems interesting to you? What are you seeing out there? We'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. I'll try to provide some insight there. First of all, I do think what you said is, you know, we've had a lot of customers kind of shift out of E&P, and it's funny how they, it's a small industry, right? They reemerge as non-op players or they reemerge as mineral players and dabble in that some. But I think, you know, non-operated leasehold is a good way to access core rock when you can't get in there as an operator, right? I think that's becoming more and more du jour, I guess, you know, buying non-op leasehold for that reason. You mentioned sort of the mineral folks, maybe they're moving to the peripheral of the basin and kind of stepping out a little bit in hopes that maybe prices get better, technology improves, these areas become commercial. That is going to be your highest kind of bang for your buck, probably, if those things do end up coming to fruition. But that's the uncertainty there is if they come to fruition, right? They may have, you know, maybe you do need a substantial price increase or commodity price increase to make it work. The other thing is, Maybe it doesn't get drilled for 15 years or whatever it is, because it is peripheral and they'll get to it one of these days when the price supports it. But the timing piece being probably the most critical value driver in all that. I mean, if we argue over whether a curve is plus or minus 20% on the reserves versus if it gets drilled next week versus 8 years from now, it's no-brainer that the timing impact there is a bigger difference to the present value than reserves difference there. So that's the risk when you buy minerals in fringier plays, fringier parts of the basin. You know, you can de-risk that as much as you can with well penetration, right? If we've got log data and some old verticals that go through the zones that, you know, we're looking at some peripheral kind of Divide County, Bakken stuff right now, where, you know, it's you've got some kind of core acreage just to the south of you there, and it's got some nice robust wells. And then you move north and you have just all old vintage, some open hole completions, you know, like you really don't have a lot of analogous data to say, what is this going to do under a new frack or a different operator. And so somebody gets out there and we get the log data we can, and we can say, well, hey, petrophysics look about the same. Maybe it's 20% thinner over here. So maybe you take your tight curve that you're using over here in the core part of the basin and you knock it down 20%, and you're buying minerals, maybe a slow play this thing again, maybe presenting two different sort of timing scenarios as part of sort of understanding where you might end up. So that's how we would approach something like that, is, again, as much as we can, go back to the rocks and see petrophysics look the same. You get the similar thickness, similar porosity, similar water saturation. This zone should perform similarly under a modern technology frac as these other areas that where we've got more development. Usually that's not the case. Usually the drill bit kind of defines where that sweet spot is, and it is worse as you move away from, you know, as you get shallower out of the basin, you lose pressure, things like that. So that's where we can come in, or a third party or an internal engineer, and help you assess what that difference in the in pro forma well might look like. Some of the basins you mentioned there, yeah, we've been doing a little bit kind of in all those, but yeah, the powder's so geologically complex, you know, it's one of the more complicated basins out there. So there's really just kind of little sweet spots here and there, and it's really hard to kind of imagine like a full-scale development out there in some of those benches. So I think that's been kind of the challenge, is like, yeah, there's some really good wells out here and there's some really terrible wells out here.
At a high level, I've heard the powder described as early days Delaware Basin from a water perspective, from an infrastructure perspective, from a geologic complexity perspective. Is that a fair statement?
You know, I don't know. Maybe, but Delaware, in my opinion, is still king of the rocks there, because you have so many producing intervals, and most of the Delaware Basin has these frac barriers kind of in between them. So, you know, I remember Inverus put together some sort of exhibit that was like how many flow units you have, right? How many actual, isolated intervals that can you go out there and punch? And a lot of the areas of the Delaware had 6 or 7, whereas the Midland, who maybe had a lot of the same formations that were deposited, didn't maybe had 1 or 2 or 3 at most, you know, sort of because we didn't have the carbonates kind of in between things to sort of isolate them. So, you know, I don't, without having logs in front of me and know kind of what the difference between those two basins that you mentioned are, the Delaware and the Powder, I wouldn't say it's necessarily totally comparison, but I think there's a lot of faulting in the Powder too that sort of makes it even more complicated than what we see in the Delaware Basin.
What about like Roberts and Leon County in Texas?
39 a day wells, yeah.
Yes, super, super deep, super expensive. It has people scratching their heads a little bit on how drilling's happening right now with gas is that, but there's a lot of chatter around that. So yeah, you're familiar with it. What do you think about that area of the world?
Yeah, I mean, if you look historically there, I think it was, I can't remember who drilled the earlier stuff. I mean, who are the operators you just mentioned?
Yeah, Comstock.
It been the one that was like back in 07, 08, punching around a little bit there too in that deep stuff. But, you know, obviously they came back to it and have had some enormously, you know, chart topping type wells. But yeah, the costs that I'm hearing on those are what, north of $25 million. I mean, I think they're very expensive. And I don't know how the gas price necessarily supports that right now. But that's a science project, and that's them collecting data on, one of these days we're gonna have our own Appalachia right here. Well, we can go turn on the sprocket and get a 30 BCF well when we need one, you know? I do think that deep, expensive drilling is, it's nice to know it's out there. I don't see it being extremely commercial right now. But again, if you've got mineral owners that are stashing this away for their grandkids, hey man, yeah, I might be interested in doing some of that. I don't know if it's gotten so much buzz that now it becomes like, no, that's not really where you buy the grandkids' minerals at, you know, because it's too competitive right now because of the press releases and such. But yeah, I think those are some enormous wells that, you know, in the right conditions would be a nice thing to hold.
Well, what's kind of the interesting thing in minerals buying is when you're taking on development timing risk and, you know, you're going into an area like that, right? If you're off a little bit and your thesis you have on well results or well timing or whatever is a little bit off, your liquidity in the secondary market is not going to be that high in that area because there's a lot of uncertainties. But in the Permian or the Haynesville, you buy white space and you're like, I think this stuff is going to get hit in 18 months. And 18 months happens, there's no line of sight and there's no visibility. You can still liquidate that at a decent number. And, you know, maybe you get your money back. Maybe you take 9 cents on the dollar. But if you want to recycle that back into something else, that dollar is still there. You might have stranded dollars in some other areas. And so that's just, you know, another element of the game that makes it fun. And, you know, there's nothing like oil men playing Russian roulette and putting some chips on the table, right? So no,
it's exciting. And from my perspective, hats off to guys out there making these deals, guys and ladies, I should say, out there making these deals, because it does take guts and it does take capital. And I'm over here on the other side of the desk just saying, this is what I think about it. This is what I think about it. So it's a little bit different risk profile.
Well, one other thing I want to talk about, we were chatting before this. When you look at building a portfolio, I think no one's going to argue against diversification and statistical significance of well bores. And Nick Varrell at Wing always talk about building a private index in the Permian. He would want to have a little bit of exposure under all the operators, because the rock in general in the core parts of the Delaware and the Permian is just so good. And so if you could have diversity amongst, you know, all the different dynamics that play that drive CapEx budgets and everything for operators, just enough exposure across all of them will be a net positive from a portfolio perspective. You were talking about how many wells are below average on performance on type curves. So let's talk about over concentration in units and just concentration risk in general. And what does the data show?
So it's sort of a phenomenon, I think, in lots of things that occur naturally, like human height, anything else, lots of other things. It's log normally distributed if you plotted all that up. And so well results are also the same, where you get these giant wells that bring the average up greater than the median. So that's what we mean by log normal. So most wells, the highest frequency of wells, like the well count below average, most wells are going to end up being below average. So that's why I said that, you know, it kind of comes back to, you got to book this distribution of results here. But that's just a little fun fact that trips people up sometimes, that most wells are below average. And yeah, Nick's right. I think if I were buying minerals, I would want to buy the distribution, right? You're going to have good wells, bad wells, great wells, okay wells, average wells. And the thing is about, and I'm speaking mostly about the unconventional basins here, you know, rule number one is offset well performance is not a reliable indicator of the next well's performance. So you can't say, because that's a 10 BCF well, and it's the next one's going to be a 10 BCF well. It might be a 4 BCF well or a 15 BCF well, right? So it's a distribution. It's a different mindset when you're talking unconventional to conventional, because you're really getting away from a deterministic number and saying, I'm going to estimate this well's reserves. What you're really doing is you're estimating what that distribution is, and you're sort of buying that distribution. So it's sort of the value concentration component. When folks bring us a deal that's I don't know, pick a big number, 15% revenue interest and some ducks, and you're like, okay, your entire deal hinges upon these two ducks that are going to get completed at a high interest. You know, that's risky, because I can't tell you if they're going to be an average well for the area, or they're going to be the very best well or the very worst well in the area. It's a wide range of outcomes, and it comes back to statistics 101 of just understanding the variability that you get with Mother Nature in these plays, that you're going to have some home runs and you're going to have some singles and doubles along the way. And so spreading that out, I think, is recommended. Again, each portfolio is different. So maybe a lot of portfolios can take that on, right, and still be in kind of their risk tolerance. But if I'm sinking all my money into buying minerals, I'm not just going to buy it in one section, right? I'm going to try to spread that around.
Yeah, I mean, on your point, it's just food for thought for those listening. If you're looking to monetize your assets and sell down portions of assets, whatever, some funds have gotten to it. This comes back to understanding the size of funds and where they're at in their broader portfolio. They might be able to take on isolated concentration risk, because blended into a portfolio, it's fine. But if they're starting the fund or they're smaller, that's going to be more heavily discounted as a result. And so it's not close to apples all the time, even though funds might have similar underwriting criteria. So it's just something to think about. I had NOG on recently, and you know, largest NOG player in the game, and they talked about this, right? They can take on more concentrated bets now because they've reached a certain level of scale. Whereas before that, they really needed the packages that had lots of operators and lots of well bores. But now if they're taking on a higher working interest exposure in a drilling partnership, for instance, they can take that bet.
from our perspective on the engineering side, one well can have different reserves for company A or company B, right? Depending on the sizes of those companies. Again, like if the proved reserves in those two ducts I described to a big company that's got 100 more ducts, it's going to, the proved reserves that I can book on those ducts is about going to be the regional average, right? Whereas if you own those two ducts and that's all you own, the proved reserves that I can book for you, Tim, is substantially lower than what I can book for the higher company. So it is worth more to the bigger company. So kind of coming back to our, you know, topic of concentration risk there. Yeah, if I was selling down to get yourself in the right size for your concentration risk, I would definitely advise like that.
Very, very interesting. Okay. Yeah, I never thought of it like that. That's just from y'all's perspective. That's really interesting. Wrapping up here, I mean, I imagine your answer is going to be we've worked everywhere. But for those who would love to reach out to you to talk about ways to work together, really hanging your hat on certain basins, you know, why don't you kind of go around the horn?
Sure. The basin, our experience is, you know, again, kind of you get best at what comes through the door. And, you know, here near term, it's been like probably most everybody, Permian focused, Haynesville focused, a little less Appalachia. We've got a good amount of customers in the DJ Basin and the Eagle Ford and the Bakken. So Oklahoma is resurging a little bit here too. We've had some longstanding customers there where, and some continuous drilling that we've been able to kind of see some of the newer stack wells. But yeah, I think, you know, pretty much all the unconventionals is where the Haas side of the team's been focused. On the Cobb side, they're supporting lithium production. There's been a big uptick recently in interest in EOR, right? Just let's optimize the water flood in our existing water flood units, or let's go initiate a new greenfield water flood, or let's look at tertiary recovery. There's a lot of that base that's emerging here too recently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I just on this last business trip I was on, I heard a lot of chatter around, you know, with this mega consolidation, smaller groups with funding, family office capital, or even some private equity groups are starting to dabble in conventional again, you know, pick up the scraps, the crumbs that fall off the table with these big mega deals and just take technology and go in and just rework wells. I think, you know, these are going to be production heavy, so you can get debt on it. So you don't necessarily need as many equity dollars, right, to acquire these assets and get started. So yeah, that's definitely, I think it's a good merger because it positions you well for a little mini trend here that's coming back in vogue. So wish you guys, you know, all the best with that. And anyone, again, listening who's interested in reaching out to Thad, feel free to do so. I can connect you as well by email offline. But thanks for coming on and sharing your thoughts. It was a fun conversation. It's not my background, so I hope you brought a lot of value to maybe the normal conversation I have, which is more strategic, finance-driven. So it was great to have you on and look forward to connecting in person again soon.
Yeah, same here, Tanner. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.